Good morning. This is Nash Gabriel with Shelley Wrench, and this is Good Medicine is Cheaper Medicine. And Shelley, today we are going to talk about guidelines and standard of care
pathways
and clinical pathways. And God forbid, what other terms or phrases we're coming up with to supposedly help us practice better medicine.
So what do you, I can tell by your introduction how you kind of are leaning towards the pathways. Now, understand, I think the listeners have to understand that, especially in the oncology realm, there are specific pathways for oncologists to follow, the NCCN guidelines and ASCO. ASCO is the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And you're actually being forced or heavily incentivized to look at these pathways and use these guidelines, I should say, and being not only incentivized by having to do it, but also by financial incentives.
Shelley, if I'm not mistaken, we had previously had two programs. One was about what's personalized medicine, and that kind of touches on today's program, because in that program we define personalized medicine. My definition is, or our definition at GCC, Gabriel Cancer Center, is every human being and every single cancer is treated differently as a unique entity, right? And today we're discussing the exact opposite of that, which is, or the antipathy to that, which is the guidelines. What the guidelines are, you want to talk about guidelines first?
Yes. Or
the guidelines are started getting established back in the late 1990s, when oncology and medicine in general start becoming more complex, more discoveries, more options of treatment. And some people, especially those in academia, where you know what people in academia do, right? They really sit behind the desk and they think a lot. And once in a while, they see patients, but they think a lot and they write a lot. And they decided that they need to write a guide to us physicians on how to treat patients. It's a very complex process.
So it was the gospel according to Luke.
According to them, yes. They thought it would be the gospel. Of course, there's a lot of people who don't believe in that. Unfortunately, though, the payers, the insurance companies, jumped into it because the insurance companies, the businessmen in the world who are not part of medicine, they don't like the idea that physicians actually are free to think and custom make treatments for patients, because that can even muddy the waters for them to be able to predict, to know what would be the potential cost of care. I think you mentioned that in the last segment.
I did. And I think it's even more interesting now that some of these payers are buying up, you know, not only specialty pharmacies, but PBMs, and they're controlling everything now. I think that with the pathways that they are choosing, it's tied to possibly contracts with different pharmaceutical companies. There was one that just came out last week that it just blew my mind. Was
United? No.
It was when they it was United Healthcare when they said, we believe that all gamma globulins are the same. Same efficacy, same outcome, same everything, right?
Yes.
But yet, we are only going to pay for two out of those seven that's on the market. Why? If they're all the same, how did they come down? It's all the same.
So for the listeners, let's connect these two dots, because that's those are two subjects that are different, but they are so
everything
linked
is tied
to each other, tied together. So when the powers to be decided to put the guidelines, if you check in the Webster Dictionary, the word guide, it almost says suggests. It gives you an idea what options there are. That's a guide, because everybody knows that medicine is a science, it's an art, it's a wisdom, it's a knowledge, it's experience. And those five, they are very hard to put them all together in one pot and put a guide on how to treat a uniquely individual patient. That was the idea. And all of a sudden, now you hear that, oh, that doctor doesn't follow guidelines. In the court now, lawyers ask, did the physician follow the guidelines? They're only a guide. The sad thing about these guides is they are only tangible in a small fraction of patients. There is a group of oncologists in Wisconsin, Minnesota, somewhere in that part of the world, where they looked into the guidelines for all cancers, trying to find out what percentage of the time the guidelines is given level A, meaning we are certain 100% that this is what you need to do for that specific scenario. Only 15% of the time we know what we're doing with certainty. 80%, 85% of the time, there are alternative options that maybe are as good, maybe worse, maybe better. Fact is, we don't know. So, like with lung cancer, first line immunotherapy, but somebody say, well, maybe chemotherapy. So that's a gray zone. But despite all that, as you mentioned a while ago, people took this as being the new gospel, according to Luke.
Well, and even we're being forced to do that with our oncology care model, that is by CMMI, which is Medicare Services. We have to prove that the regimen that we, that I can't say choose, that you choose, that you're forced to choose, is being given to our OCM patients. And we have to document that in the chart.
So go back, Shelley, into, again, philosophically. We really have to have philosophy in all these things because, and psychology, because these things, they just don't show up out of nowhere without a purpose. There are many purposes for these guidelines. Number one, academics want to tell people like me, you do things the way I say. Well, I tell them go to hell, right? Because I do things the way I see it, right?
Yes.
That's one. The whole society, not the physicians, but the paramedical society, the business part of medicine, the nursing, and so on, they loved it. Why? Because if now physicians are to follow an algorithm religiously, what differentiates Dr. A from Dr. B or C or D?
It's just algorithms.
It's algorithms, which means you don't actually have to have a doctor to, okay, lung cancer, you treat with this chemo. You look at the guidelines that are available online, right? And I think it all goes back to one thing. Throughout history, philosophically again, throughout history, societies have always tried to undermine the intellectual power and authority of the intelligent.
Right.
Because the top tier of the IQ in the society is only about 2.5% of the population. That's the standard deviation of the bell curve, which means 97.5% of the population are less intelligent than those 2.5%. So by sheer numbers, they can beat the hell out of them. Do you ever wonder why we had the Illuminati society? It was a secret society of the intelligent. Who were they? Galileo, Isaac Newton, Da Vinci. These were the bright, bright, bright people. But they kept their societies in secret because they were a small minority. The Masons, same thing. Throughout history, the intelligent people have been always discriminated against and always been undermined because nobody wants, or more the population at large, they don't want the intelligent to shine because they make the others feel not so shiny. And now all of a sudden we discover the method. Just imagine the Masons were the first group because they had that ability to measure angles and build, right?
Right.
I mean, to us today, simple thing, amazing, right? But they were the ultimate artists. Can you imagine in those days, if they had the ability, if the layman, the general public, if they had the ability to standardize the construction so that you eliminate the innovation and talent of the masons, right? Then they would say, okay, everybody can be a mason. They couldn't in those days. So what did? They fought them. So they went in hiding and they created their own secret society. Whenever you have a secret society, you start getting rituals. And this is my philosophical and historic perspective on the guidelines.
Thank you for that. Really deep. Thinking about those intelligent people that are in the secret society making decisions, though, I know that you don't use the NCCN evidence blocks. I don't even know if you've ever seen the evidence blocks.
Although when I look back, I'm compliant with them 85% of the time.
Right.
And insurance companies require compliance 80% of the time. What does it tell you? They just copy the book and put it there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the evidence blocks, there's two parts of the evidence blocks. And I just real quickly, it's the quality of evidence of the trials.
Right.
And it is the consistency of trials. So I'm thinking, knowing what we know with the trials that we do, they're basing these evidence blocks on trials that sometimes don't include all patients. Like we've had in prior episodes, we're talking about we're only including the healthier patients and maybe not the typical population. And that's what we're building these guidelines on. So it trickles down all the way to the source documentation, where the source documentation being clinical trials that might not include all of the proper population.
And that would explain the frequency by which some items are dropped from the guideline, because as you said, they go by the quality of a trial, and then after 2 years somebody discovers that there was a problem with the trial, so they resend. There is a bigger problem, a real big problem with the guidelines. So for each disease, there is a committee of physicians, usually from academia, right? They are chosen to write a guideline for that disease and update it periodically. All of them have really strong ties to the drug companies. So we are all humans, right?
Yeah.
And what is the thing that influences the behavior of human beings the most?
Money.
Money. I used to think it was sex, according to Freud, but Freud was dead wrong. Because Freud thought that even when an ant walks in one direction, it's seeking sex. These guys, no. Dobbins and Levitt and Dobbins, these are the authors of the books for economics. Mm-hmm. They think that money is the strongest stimulus or incentive for human beings. So when these guys design write the guidelines, and they are consultants and do work. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with being a consultant to a company, because I do that.
We both do.
We both do that. It will be hard for me to be convinced that these guys don't insert their subconscious bias. Again, psychology and philosophy. There is a subconscious bias in us that will make us shift one way or another. Meaning, it's possible that if you are a consultant for Genentech, if Genentech is putting $100,000 a year in your pocket, it will be hard for you to convince me that you will not be biased towards a Genentech product when you design the guidelines. Do you agree with that?
I do. Hopefully, Genentech and the others don't look at, don't listen to our episodes.
They can.
But listen to it though. Here we are. We do, our consultants, but yet we're spelling out the facts.
Well, can I talk politics a little bit?
Sure.
Some people might disagree with this, but I have to say it because I have the First Amendment on my side, right? I can say whatever I want. I always thought we are safer to elect wealthy people to government offices because I think they are less corruptible. Same with medicine. I make more money than academic. It will take drug companies a lot more money to buy my conscience. It will take them a little bit less, a little bit money to buy the conscience of somebody who makes 10% of what I make. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So back to these people who write the guidelines. There is a quote I can from a guy, his name was Upton Sinclair. He said, "It is difficult to get a man understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it."
Yes, I remember that.
Remember that?
Yes.
So this, the academic who's making X amount of money from a drug company, significant amount of money, I'm not saying they are evil people, no. It's just the human, the nature of the beast, the human nature. That because his salary, salary depends on his decision, because when Genentech will look at the guidelines and they will go to him and say, "What did you do? We give you so much money for your consultation, for your research, for your this, and that's what you do. You put our drugs as option number three." There was Dr. Bernstein, his name. He's the editor of the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. He wrote an editorial about 2 years ago, and he said he was concerned that the guidelines are tinted with the influence of drug companies. And he mentioned it. He said, yes, the guys who write the guidelines, they do this disclaimer. Yeah, I get paid, but what does disclaimer do to me? Disclaimer doesn't help me because subconsciously you're already biased. And according to Sinclair, you will make decisions that are subconscious, that are in favor of what makes you money.
And, you know, the payers are the same way. The payers are choosing their pathways to make them money. And I don't know if a lot of people outside of healthcare understand, when we go to decide on a regimen for a patient, depending on their insurance, depends on whether we have to follow a pathway or not. And when we go onto the payer's portal, put in the patient's name, date of birth, indication, we always have to put the body weight and BSI and all that kind of stuff. And it populates the regimens that we are to choose from. And sometimes there might be only one regimen. There sometimes might be two regimens, but not a whole lot of them.
Oh, what do they say, the payers? Well, we make sure that you practice safe medicine.
Yeah, they think there's going to be less errors.
I think safe medicine to them is save me money. That's the save. It's it's save money.
Yeah, they put so many reasons behind it.
So they will put any. We'll put, you're right. Restrictions on the expensive drugs that they don't want to.
Not always.
Not always. Yes, you're right. Not always.
This is where we always disagree, because remember, they keep 17% of their payouts. So you and I, we'll just agree to disagree on that point. But
well, you know, I'm always the one who thought that insurance companies have no interest in lowering costs. But for the budget of the year, they want to contain cost. But they also want the total cost to go up every year. Once they get their premium for the year, that's it. They have to live with that. And anything they save for that year is in their pocket. For next year, so they will go and negotiate. They negotiate again, but they make sure that the negotiated terms will also give them enough money. They don't want to lower the cost drastically so that the premium will drop. They don't want. But anyway, that's besides the point.
Yeah, yeah.
What bothers me the most is that a guideline became like the rule in the court sometimes, which is a guide. And I explained to you a while ago, for the last half an hour, the pitfall of guidelines. And second, more importantly, is that payers are using those false claims by the guys, the tinted claims by the guys who designed the guidelines, to be the gospel again. And that's the dangerous part of medicine.
And we even get from the payers, we get a quarterly report saying, how often did we follow guidelines? How often did we follow the pathway? So we get those reports, and if we're not following, we get penalized.
There was a patient I saw that day, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, 300 pounds, high blood pressure and diabetes. The standard treatment is considered R-CHOP. If you give this guy R-CHOP, definitely he will die of heart failure, or he will develop congestive heart failure within a matter of 2-3 months. So I decided to choose an equal regimen, but lower dose of one of the drugs.
Right.
And we got a note from a nurse at the insurance company. She said, I recommend you use R-CHOP because she's reading the guideline. Imagine how blinding it is, that poor nurse sitting there reading a guideline on the phone tells me, the expert who knows the patient, who kind of knows his medicine.
Has examined the patient.
Examined the patient and see the risk. Oh, no. The guideline is R-CHOP. It blew my mind. Of course, I said to her, yeah, okay, we'll do R-CHOP. I just lowered the dose. Unfortunately, I cannot give the additional drugs because I'm not interested in killing patients because the insurance wants me to. I don't want to do that.
Right.
It's sad, though. It's sad that they are taking all these guidelines as if they are the Ten Commandments by Moses. And everybody seemed to follow.
Well, it's talking about everybody wanting to follow them. Think about the software vendors that are out there selling their pathways. And you have some practices that have built pathways. And then they spent so much money on IT and MDs building these pathways and with their software company. And they tried to get their money back by selling it across the board. There's just so many people who want to cash in on this pathways process.
And think also about what we talked about last in the previous episode, personalized medicine. The guideline says you treat everybody equal. Again, sociology, philosophy, and politics. We have to treat everybody equal. There is no difference between people depending on their body weight or their gender or race. They're all the same. And if I do that to the patient I just discussed that I started treating 3 weeks ago, he would be dead because I treated him equal to the others. This is the value of personalized medicine that some powers to be, they want to undermine. I think it's all philosophical thing. It's all the liberal move that we have to equalize things. Equalize patients, equalize talent, equalize abilities. We all are the same. If given the opportunity, we all are the same. So if somebody didn't have opportunity to be a physician, well, give them opportunity by giving them software for the guideline, and they'll be a doctor too. And the poor patient will not have the chance to be treated as a unique, simple, single human being.
Well, it's all part of the new thing that's coming out, the value-based medicine, right? That's what this all leads into, is they want to, and that's the evidence blocks. It shows not only the trial information, but the cost of each regimen and has it in these nice little Rubik's Cube blocks. So you can see, okay, this one has, you know, great outcomes, great safety profile, and it's low in cost. So that's a bingo, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can see it across the board. And it's tied to all this value-based medicine instead of volume-based, which I agree that we need to move out of volume-based because, like we've said in a prior episode, physicians get paid based on the volume of what they do. And so you don't want like the physicians that take 3 or 4 office visits and lots of testing to get to the bottom of a diagnosis. I agree that there's got to be something different rather than someone who comes to you and in the first office visit or two and, you know, maybe a simple bone marrow biopsy or a biopsy alone, you've discovered a diagnosis, which is oodles less than what you would have cost that patient had you sent them through all the extra testing. So I don't know what the end result's going to be, but I don't believe that the way that we're going with the pathways is the best way to go with understanding all the biases and all the politics and all the money that's driven it within the pathways.
Shall we think about it this way? There's another twist to it besides the philosophy and the history and all that. People who are seeking methods to measure outcomes, they're struggling. They're struggling not because they are unable. They're struggling because it is a difficult task. It is a difficult task to compare two physicians, to compare their quality and their outcomes and the cost and so on, especially the metrics you want to establish. The guidelines came as God's gift metric to the bean counters. The bean counters are the people who who want something to measure. So what do they say now? If you are compliant with the guidelines 80% of the time, you are a good boy or a good girl. And if you are less than 80%, then shame on you, because you are not doing what the majority of people are supposed to be doing. I think that is one of the reasons that push some people to accept it. When you know, when they ask us in during meetings, especially ad boards, how many of you? I was in the one in Houston last week. There were about 15 of us. How many of you follow guidelines? It was funny to see them. Even those who raised their hand, they barely showed their fingertips above the table. Because Sophia said,
and those were probably only the ones that are in OCM.
Yeah.
Because they had to.
And in fact, at that time, I did mention to them, it's becoming like those who don't use the guidelines are becoming like Trump supporters. You don't dare say in public, I support Trump, because everyone's saying, oh, you're crazy if you support Trump. Yet, when you went to the polls, he won hands down, right?
Right.
My golf clubs, I still have Make America Great Again as the cover for my, because I feel I'm proud of what I believe in. I'm proud that he's our president. I think he's great. The fact that some people think it's crazy to even support him, I don't fall for that. And I think the guidelines are very much similar. People are shy to say the deplorables, are shy to say that I don't follow guidelines. I think the good docs, I have met a lot of brilliant physicians who say, it's a piece of garbage. It's a piece of politics. But nobody can say it because they don't say it in public, because you are antagonizing the big academia, the Cleveland Clinic, the Harvard, the Mayo Clinic, because those guys make money on being on those committees. And philosophically, they are the liberals who want everything to be done as they deem so, rather than who are you, Dash Gabriel, to decide independently how to treat every patient individually. Well, you know what? I can, and I do, and I'm proud of it.
Exactly. Well, it's been very interesting again. Listeners can review our prior episodes at GabrielCancerCenter.com. We have an archived all of our episodes there. And it's been great.
Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you.
Again, managed to combine philosophy, medicine, politics, and economics in one half of the segment.
Okay.